This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And police departments telling you what you should listen to. Stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial, unless your FM was made in America.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we hear a veteran CIA analyst's thoughts on today's nomination of John Brennan as the new director of the CIA.
10 major U.S. banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America, will pay $8.5 billion to customers whose homes were wrongfully foreclosed on.
And the FCC finds that U.S. prisoners are charged $1 per minute for phone calls, compared to the average American who pays roughly 5 cents per minute for long-distance calls. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 7th, 2013. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Serena Fong. Following 8 months of investigating, the Oregonian has released an article on driver fatigue with Portland's public transit organization, TriMet. The Oregonian found over 21 cases of driver fatigue-related incidents in a three-and-a-half-year period. Though drivers are required to take a 7-hour break in between shifts, TriMet does allow them to manipulate their time, and some drivers have worked up to 22 hours in a 24-hour period. TriMet claims that with the hiring freeze in 2009, rather than canceling lines and leaving people stranded on a route, drivers have jumped in and begun working overtime to keep buses running. The Oregonian also claims that some TriMet drivers earn over $100,000 a year, often due to overtime pay. Though federal law requires limits on hours railroad, pilots, truck drivers, and charter bus operators can work, the laws don't apply to public transit drivers. However, TriMet says it will begin negotiating with the union over limiting driver hours in the near future.
A lawsuit has been filed against the Vancouver, British Columbia tour bus operator involved in the December 30th crash near Pendleton, Oregon, which killed 9 passengers. The crash, which occurred on a mountainous stretch of Interstate 84, saw the tour bus slide down a sheer 200-foot embankment where it threw some passengers from the coach upon impact. Multiple people were also injured in the crash. The lawsuit, brought by attorney Charles Herman of Tacoma, Washington, is on behalf of 2 minors injured in the crash. The suit alleges that the driver working for Miju Tour and Travel doubled as a tour guide for the first 8 days of the trip from Las Vegas to Vancouver, British Columbia, which the suit says violated federal regulations regarding maximum allowable hours for on-duty drivers.
This weekend in Silverdale, Washington, a concealed handgun fell out of a man's pocket and discharged when it hit the floor. And yesterday in Mesa, Washington, a 14-year-old boy accidentally shot his brother in the stomach with their parents' gun. This follows an incident 2 weeks ago in Tillamook, Oregon, when a loaded gun was found in a movie theater. The owner had forgotten it on his seat after a showing of The Hobbit. Since the shooting of dozens of elementary school students in Newtown, Connecticut in December, people across the U.S. have continued to buy guns and assert their right to carry a concealed weapon. But following these 2 incidents in the Pacific Northwest and dozens of similar incidents around the country, gun control advocates are questioning the safety of allowing concealed handguns to be carried in public. This follows the controversial assertion by the National Rifle Association that, quote, "the best way to deal with a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun." Internationally, the U.S. has more handguns per capita than any other country. There are almost 90 guns per 100 people in the U.S. Second to the U.S. is Serbia, which has nearly 60 guns per 100 people. Gun deaths in the U.S. are higher than any other country not fighting a war on its own soil.
President Barack Obama has nominated former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel to head the Department of Defense. The move is expected to draw controversy, with congressional conservatives prepared to jump on Hagel's opposition to sanctions on Iran and his willingness to engage Islamic militant groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas. Obama's pick to head the Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan, has served as Obama's counterterrorism advisor and has been a lightning rod for criticism about the government's policy of extrajudicial killings and the use of unmanned aerial drones. KABU's Mike Klepfer spoke with former CIA analyst and anti-war activist Ray McGovern about Brennan's nomination.
Let's start out with some background. Can you tell me a little bit about President Obama's pick to head the CIA, John Brennan?
I've worked for 9 CIA directors, so I know a little bit about the qualities needed in one. Integrity is first and foremost. Honesty is another. Brennan is sadly lacking in both. The background of this, of course, is that he was one of the foremost advocates of what they call extraordinary rendition, short for kidnapping, torture, black site prisons where detainees, so to speak, were tortured, illegal eavesdropping. Most recently, he's famous for preparing the so-called kill list for the president to peruse every Tuesday before drones are set about to kill militants or terrorists or insurgents, or whatever you want to call them, so-called because they look suspicious or because one of their neighbors that doesn't like them in Pakistan has put a little device in their house and the missile homes in on it.
What direction do you think this means that the CIA is going in if Obama has tapped Brennan?
So there are basically 2 CIAs, is a shorthand way of saying this. One is the one that Truman intended, which was no more nor less than a independent outfit, independent of the Pentagon and of the State Department, where he could go for a straight answer on what was going on in the world. And that's the CIA I served in. The operational thing was tacked on as an afterthought after World War II, and it's been the bane of the CIA's existence ever since. There's no cogent reason for having operations like drones in the same agency, which is tasked in its primary capacity to tell the president what's going on in the world without fear or favor.
There was just a drone strike in Pakistan reported over the weekend in which 18 people were killed. The government, of course, claims that only militants were killed in the attack. But this seems to fit a pattern where, you know, civilians are, you know, sometimes killed in these attacks. John Brennan famously claimed in 2011 that there were no collateral deaths attributable to drones. What do you think of an attitude of a government official such as this, somebody that's being asked to lead the entire CIA?
But I think one needs a record for credibility and integrity. Brennan doesn't have that. He lies like a trooper. Now, the one you mentioned, of course, is a case in point. Getting up 2 Junes ago and saying, over almost the entire previous year, not one civilian has suffered from the assault of the drones. He was left out of the room. There are hundreds that have been so killed, and people verify that on both the Pakistani and the Afghan side. With respect to Pakistan, this is really important. People don't realize that there are 180 million people in Pakistan, okay? 180 million. They have a nuclear capability. And what are we doing? We're giving the insurgents there, the real terrorists, every reason to attack their government, to subvert it, and to perhaps even in the end take hold of those nuclear weapons. We are creating the conditions by what we're doing with the drone strikes to make anyone who's a friend of America or who is seen to be participating in targeting or in otherwise an enemy. How they could be so short-sighted in thinking that killing 2 or 3 al-Qaeda people who were immediately replaced by other al-Qaeda people, how that would serve the U.S. interests when each one of those strikes, the extended family of each victim is 100 people, and the Pashtuns don't like people like that. So we're buying off trouble. It's almost, you know, it's almost not cynical to say that either Brennan is really dumb, and that's possible, or he's a tool of the military-industrial complex. Because when you look at the effect of what he's doing, well, he's just ensuring that there'll be a plentiful supply of terrorists or militants or insurgents to deal with, and our corporations that are profiteering on these wars will be in really good shape in the years to come.
All right, Mr. McGovern, thank you for your time.
Yeah, I wish I could give you a happier tale here.
Well, we'll see. This is Mike Klepfer, KBU News.
You are listening to the KBU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, connecting with the community inside. At 7, hear Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be rainy in the morning, with overcast skies throughout the day, highs near 53 degrees. Tomorrow evening should see continued rain, lows around 42.
It's 5:11 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Finally, in the 11th hour and 59th minute, Republicans and Democrats negotiated a fiscal reform package, which they touted as the American Taxpayer Relief Act. But if you had been allowed to peek behind the curtain during the deal-making, you would have noticed that the Dems and Repubs were not alone, and some taxpayers were getting extra special relief. Captain Morgan, Bacardi, and other Caribbean rum peddlers, for example, were at the table, picking up a $500 million liquor subsidy. NASCAR wheeled in to win a multi-million-dollar loophole for building racetracks. Railroad conglomerates hauled off a $165 million bundle for maintaining their own tracks. Disney and other fabulously wealthy Hollywood studios reeled in a $75 million subsidy for making movies. And Big Coal mined the negotiation for a federal giveaway to buy safety equipment and provide safety training for their workers. But the big dogs in the room, as usual, were Wall Street hucksters. Tucked inside the reform bill is Section 322, opaquely titled Extension of Subpart F Exception for Active Financing Income. In plain English, that line of gobbledygook will move $9 billion this year from our public treasury into the already overflowing coffers of Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and other fiefdoms of high finance. Worse than the giveaway, however, is the provision's purpose. As explained by the excellent watchdog group Citizens for Tax Justice, Section 322 essentially underwrites the financing of corporate offshoring, a $9 billion subsidy for moving more U.S. jobs to foreign countries. This is Jim Hightower saying, Italians have a useful phrase that applies here. Qui bono? Who benefits? Yes, this Republican-Democrat compromise has some good provisions, but deep inside, it's the same old corporate ugliness.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. It was the Saturday between Christmas and New Year's, and a far-flung group of volunteers with Occupy Sandy had come together at St. John's Episcopal Church in the Bay Ridge section of Brooklyn to cook meals for hurricane victims. Half a dozen of the volunteers were young people in a green jobs training and college prep program who came in on their week off to help. WIN's Melinda Tuhus has more.
Green City Force is part of AmeriCorps. To be eligible, young people must be between 18 and 24 years old, live in public housing, and have a high school diploma or a GED. Cindra Davis lives in Red Hook, Brooklyn, which was devastated by Hurricane Sandy. She's college-bound, but is getting her green education on a city farm.
I work in the Red Hook Community Farm, learning how to maintain a farm and what it takes to maintain a farm, because we are also building a farm in the Red Hook development.
The farm has a sophisticated food composting operation, which Davis described in detail. Coincidentally, the garbage bags full of food scraps generated by the Occupy Sandy Bay Ridge kitchen go to the farm for processing into what organic farmers call black gold, rich, humusy earth that vegetables thrive in.
You also, if you want to get somebody started on chopping some celery.
Davis says there's another connection between Green City Force participants and Occupy Sandy Relief that explains why these young adults are spending their Saturday chopping squash, potatoes, and celery that will be turned into delicious hot meals to be delivered to families who are still unable to cook their own food.
Mainly, like, a lot of people in the program have been affected by the hurricane, and I also live in an area that was really affected bad by the hurricane, so we're just, like, offering helping services to people and just, like, helping out when we could.
She says her family had to evacuate for 2 weeks, and things are still far from normal, although there is intermittent power.
And, like, sometimes there'll be hot water, and then sometimes there'll be cold water, sometimes there'll be no water, no heat.
Different volunteers take turns heading up the cooking and dispatching the food from the Bay Ridge kitchen, as many as 2,000 meals a day. On Saturday, it was Jamie Kemmerer and his wife, Alicia, who have spent almost every Saturday for the past 2 months cooking for hurricane survivors.
You know, some of them have electricity, some of them don't, some of them have gas, some of them don't. Literally, we've been providing food to some of these same families since the storm. So if we were to just quit, who would be providing for those families? So I feel like until we know that those families are on their own feet or able to cook or, you know, have some source of food, we have to keep doing it. You know, we just have to.
This report has been made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
According to the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, phone calls to people in prison from family and friends to people in prison cost more today than they ever have in the past. Most prison phone calls are routed through two companies, Global Tellink and Securus Technologies Incorporated. The FCC claims that this creates a monopoly that would be reversed if companies charged callers the same rates as for any other call. However, these companies charge $15 for a 15-minute call, which can cause a financial strain on families with members in prison, many of whom are already low income. Many prison phone contracts require a commission or location fee be paid to the correctional facility for each phone call. However, the Center for Media Justice adds that 8 states have banned phone commissions, including California, South Carolina, Nebraska, New Mexico, New York, Rhode Island, Michigan, and Missouri, and in those states, prison phone calls are significantly less expensive. FCC Commissioner Minion L. Clyburn reports that phone calls and emails have poured in from thousands of people demanding lower prices for prison phone calls. The FCC will receive feedback on its proposal to reduce the cost of phone calls to prisons in the next 2 months, and Clyburn urges the public to get involved in this cause.
Most banks proudly claim they are good corporate citizens, but an independent watchdog group in the world of charitable giving is challenging that image. Investigating the donations of 4 megabanks over a 5-year period, it found their definitions of philanthropy don't add up to much in terms of quantity or quality of charitable contributions. For more, KBOO's Jennifer Kemp, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, has the story.
In an effort to rebuild their tarnished reputations, the nation's biggest banks are touting their charitable contributions and community involvement. But on closer inspection, a new report says they're not so charitable after all. The National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy has examined the contributions of 4 megabanks over 5 years. Report author Sean Dobson says the banks include making low-interest loans to for-profit companies and employees' volunteer hours when tallying their charitable giving, and overall, they spend a fraction of 1% of total revenue on philanthropy.
They brag a lot about their charitable donations, and they brag loudest and most often whenever they're in Washington, D.C., lobbying lawmakers to try to water down financial reforms that will safeguard the public against fraud, abuse, and another financial collapse.
The institutions in the report are Bank of America, JPMorgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Wells Fargo. Dobson says his group doesn't want Congress to be, in his words, hoodwinked by the mega bank's claim of generosity as lawmakers work on more stringent banking regulations. Also in the report, an evaluation of how the banks fared in meeting the National Committee for Responsible Philanthropy's minimum benchmarks for responsible giving. For instance, using at least half of their charitable dollars to benefit vulnerable populations instead of, say, Ivy League schools, or giving nonprofits more flexible, multi-year grants instead of one-time amounts. Dobson says none of the four banks met those standards.
In fact, these four mega banks, their philanthropy compared to other big financial institutions is actually mediocre in terms of its quantity and its quality, and also it lacks transparency. Much of it cannot be verified.
He explains a bank typically gives in two ways, through a separate charitable foundation, where the records are public and can be tracked, and from their own corporate treasury, which is private information and cannot be confirmed even if the company is publicly traded. This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Two major settlements have been reached with banks involved in the housing boom and bust that led to the global financial crisis. Federal regulators announced an $8.5 billion settlement with 10 banks, including Citibank, JP Morgan Chase, and Bank of America, over its handling of mortgages. Regulators accused the banks of committing fraud, including submitting flawed paperwork on foreclosures and inadequately processing loan modifications for homeowners. The majority of the apportioned money will go to homeowners who have suffered during the housing crisis, providing an estimated $3.3 billion for homeowners who went into foreclosure in 2009 and 2010. $5.2 billion will go to other forms of assistance for embattled homeowners, including money for principal reductions and loan modifications. The settlement comes on the heels of the $25 billion nationwide mortgage settlement last year, which saw the country's five largest mortgage lenders promise a comprehensive review of mortgages they had issued. However, according to banks and federal regulators, the review process proved too costly and time-consuming and did not yield results that regulators were hoping for. While being greeted as the best solution to the housing crisis so far, critics of the foreclosure deal say the banks are still paying too low a price. The payout guidelines allow wronged homeowners to receive less compensation than the original damages incurred, according to Diane Thompson of the National Consumer Law Center. In the second settlement announced today, Bank of America agreed to pay $10 billion to Fannie Mae over mortgages handled by its subsidiary Countrywide Financial and sold to Fannie Mae, the quality of which were alleged by the government to have been highly overrated. As a condition of the suit, Bank of America will pay $3.6 billion in cash to Fannie Mae and buy back an estimated 30,000 mortgages for $6.75 billion. Both settlements absolve banks of criminal wrongdoing. Numerous civil suits between banks, private investors, and other financial entities are still pending.
The chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, has issued a new report that acknowledges the widespread failure of austerity measures around the world. Chief economist Olivier Blanchard said that economic forecasters significantly underestimated the effects that major spending cuts would have on unemployment and investment growth. Austerity measures have been implemented in Europe following the beginning of the current recession. Similar policies have been championed by Republicans in the United States and have informed much of the debate on the so-called fiscal cliff. The report noted that while Europe's growth has stagnated under austerity, the U.S. has seen modest growth following the economic stimulus of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. The report also indicated that while raising taxes on the highest earners seemed to show no slowdown in investment, lowering taxes on those earning the most was correlated with increasing wealth consolidation among the wealthiest. The report seems to agree with the theories of economist John Maynard Keynes, whose idea that governments needed to create large injections of capital to overcome debt crisis has been credited with helping to end the Great Depression. Business Insider has heralded the IMF's paper as a triumph of Keynesian economics over the theories of other economic thinkers, such as Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. Their relatively more conservative theories, and others like them, have formed the backbone of thinking in the IMF for over 20 years. The report also largely agreed with one put out last September by the Congressional Research Service, which focused chiefly on U.S. economic policy. There is no indication yet that either report suggests major changes from the IMF or the United States Congress.
96 people have been arrested and 62 police officers have been injured in the most recent round of sectarian violence in Belfast, Northern Ireland. According to the BBC, bricks and petrol bombs are the weapons of choice of British loyalist protesters during these clashes. The protests came after a Belfast City Council vote to limit the number of days which the Union flag flies. English Protestant paramilitaries in the Progressive Unionist Party took to the street December 3rd, where many of the demonstrators have links to the Ulster Volunteer Force, considered a terrorist organization by both the United Kingdom and United States. There have been reports of children as young as 10 becoming involved in the riots. Belfast police have been increasing their presence in the city.
Scientists in Pilbara in Western Australia have analyzed patterns on rocks that they believe to have been forged by fossilized bacteria that dates back 3.5 billion years. Geologists found carbon-13 present in the fossils. Carbon-13 is a type of carbon that is a remnant in fossilized beings and only makes up about 1% of all types of carbon found on Earth. Scientists were not able to confirm whether this is the product of bacterial fossilization because the area of present-day Western Australia used to be a shoreline during the Archean period, and water could have been instrumental in the design's formation. Similar patterns have been seen on rocks discovered in South Africa and Tunisia that date back to about 2.9 billion years. Researchers believe that organisms in the Archean period will reveal not only the sequence of how life began on Earth, but also if there was any non-Earth agents that were necessary to facilitate the development of proto-beings.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Mike Klepfer, Jennifer Kemp, Angelique O'Rourke, Zoe White, and Desiree Garcia. The producer is Serena Fong. Special thanks to reporters from laborradio.org. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the newscast tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab a pen or something else to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Serena Fong. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez.
At 8, Joe Uris hosts the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. His topic is the circus of official politics. At 9, on Alternative Radio, you can hear activist, journalist, and author Bill McKibben speak on the climate cliff.
At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
At 11 on Stage and Studio, guest host SW Concert interviews Portland artist Tad Savineur, co-author of the play Talk Radio. KABU is screening the film Talk Radio this Thursday night at the Clinton Street Theater. And at 11 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews photographer Christopher Rauschenberg about Museum, his show of recent photographs at the Elizabeth Leach. Thanks, KBOO members, for your ongoing support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Andrew.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 7th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, human rights groups protest President Obama's nominees to head the CIA and the Pentagon, noting concerns about torture, civil liberties, and the drone program. Members of the LGBT community in Uganda bring a U.S.-based evangelical leader to court for what they say is his role in shaping anti-gay legislation and discrimination in the country. And we'll go to Indian-administered Kashmir, where activists continue their efforts to expose the impunity given to police and security forces involved in human rights violations. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. The Shell-owned oil rig that ran aground in Alaska last week is under tow today. The Killick was cut free from a tugboat amid 24-foot swells. It's now bound for a sheltered bay where investigators can assess its stability. It's carrying about 160,000 gallons of diesel and other petroleum products. So far, there's no sign of leakage, but the U.S. Coast Guard and two oil spill response vessels are sailing alongside just in case. A church of mostly immigrants in New Haven, Connecticut, is calling for the state to grant driver's licenses to all eligible residents, regardless of immigration status. Supporters held a rally Sunday. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Several hundred parishioners at St. Rose of Lima Church and their supporters in the faith-based organization Connect, or Congregations Organized for a New Connecticut, are calling for the state to issue driver's licenses for all otherwise qualified undocumented residents, not just those who fall under deferred action, a federal program that allows some youth to stay in the country. Myra, who declined to give her last name, said her mother was stopped by